I mean, it's big. It knocks all the seismographs off of their pins. The Geiger counters at Harvard blow up and fuse out every time they blow one. And a little Geiger counter, which I've got, always have a little fun with the newspapers by calling up and asking them very indignantly about the A-bomb. Has there been an attack on New York, I normally say, or something of this sort, just to get them upset. Because a little Geiger counter I've got sitting up there, whenever one of these things goes off, all you have to do, you know, is seal it, so that if anything activates it, you know it's been activated. You come back and take a look at it. You know there's been some radioactive material someplace or another, because its needle's gone off its pins. Well, that little thing, the other day, went whir, click, and broke itself. Just a little Geiger counter. It doesn't amount to anything. Send the government a bill, I guess. Anyway, here you have somebody that's in there. He's really trying. See, he's got a... nobody quite believes he's president. They probably believed he was a general. But he's getting more backlash from the U.S. than he could possibly stand up to. For instance, they have a big starvation of cattle and all of that sort of thing. You know, and they had... Remember that? He didn't even give anybody any help. They just canceled all the Democratic Party programs and everything else, just suddenly. Nobody gave any food to it, and beef got upset, and so on. Well, boy, right about that time, when he took his finger off his number, he started to get backlash. You're going to find this boy, and this is just a little prediction. He's only been in office a year now. We got a three-ring circus in 3 years to go. Now, I don't want this publicly quoted. That's why I'm putting it on a tape. we've got 3 years of a little man who had to be famous. And they're going to be rough. In the first place, what's the training of a general? Well, somebody comes up and says, I don't feel like working today. Think I'll go play golf. A general says, sir, you will report to your quarters and hold yourself under arrest for the convenience of the court-martial board. Private doesn't polish his shoes. Shoot him. As a matter of fact, this guy, Eisenhower, shot the only American soldier to be shot for desertion since 1854. Something on that order, way back. From such date. In a century, nobody has shot a soldier for desertion, and Eisenhower, during the last war, heard of an isolated case, a little guy by the name of Slovak. He up and had him shot. It's like that. Boom. Gotta make that postulate stick, see? What I say goes. Well, the American public don't happen to be soldiers. They're not even good privates. When you get them in as officers, you tear your hair out by the roots. You say, how can this happen to an army or a navy? Fella comes in, throws his golf clubs in the corner of his stateroom, and comes out on deck in a pair of sneakers and an old cap and thinks he's on a yachting trip. And the odd part of it is the guy will get his job done. Well, what's the dismay of somebody who is accustomed to complete obedience all through the years of his life, who says to the American public, now, what we want is a reduced consumption of lollipops, because our production of lollipops is something that the American public should wear some more lollipops. See, chomp, chomp, chomp. Now, I want you all to cooperate so that we won't have any more deflationary inflation and so forth. Everybody says, oh, what's that guy's loud voice over there someplace? They don't want anything to do with it. They're not soldiers. And this is going to drive that boy mad before he gets through. That's just a little prediction. This is 1954. Look at it in 1957. Just make you a little bet. Unless somebody does the same for him as they did for the last president. You should know that the psychiatrist in charge of the case of the last president was a deep student of Dianetics and never missed getting a single publication or book from the foundation. And when you saw Truman, if you saw the Democratic Convention, you saw a little man walk up there bouncing, well, let's all get the show on the road, he was saying. You know, lots of pep and so forth. You know, most presidents come out of the White House saying, where's the sidewalk? Oh, I don't say that Truman was processed all the way through to release. He was only processed halfway or something. But I don't say he had any processing at all. It just is a mysterious thing that the psychiatrist who was treating him was one of my best pupils. Anyway, we get into a problem when we get some gubbity getting up into these altitudes, you see. Now, I'm not talking to you politically. To hell with politics. I might as well be talking about Tiberius or Augustus or Julius Caesar or any other top dog or Mechnikov or Stalinovich or Kaiser Bill or Hitler or Mussolini or any one of these boys. They've all done the same thing, you see. They get up there, strata. See? They won't obey, so I'll make them obey. So that puts them up another rank. Oh, they won't obey here, so I'll make them obey. That puts them up another rank. Oh, they won't obey here, so I've got to go up another rank. They won't obey here, so I've got to go another... The only reason they don't attend to and achieve the high station of God is because they don't live that long ordinarily, you see. They don't live long enough to get promoted up to that point. That'd be the only real reason. And this doesn't say that every person in command is a dog. Only 99% of them are dogs. So let's not make this a blanket statement. I'd like to be known for careless statements. Only 99%. These people get up to this level on their own, being driven in. That is the type of personality which becomes Hitler, which goes up. Any man who goes up through the military is, of course, compounding the felony continually. You know, see, he doesn't have to accept that next rank. He doesn't have to. He gets a letter that says, you are now hereby promoted, and so on. Well, he can look at the captain of his ship. The old man has ulcers. He has a furrowed brow, gray hair. He's in horrible shape. He's about to cave in. He looks at this old fella, you see, and he wants a promotion to that man's rank. The guy must be crazy. And yet they grab him. They take their examination. They worry and fuss. Well, he say more money. Yeah, but the more money he gets, the more things he'll have. And the more things he possesses, the more trouble they'll get him into. This is the messed universe at work. Let's get a higher rank, a greater order. Let's be more thoroughly identified. In other words, let's be less free and more nailed down and specialized in that viewpoint. See this? What's this all add up to? Whether it's Eisenhower or Hitler or Augustus, who does it add up to? It adds up to a fellow who I must be the only one who possesses this viewpoint. I am the only one who can possess this viewpoint, and I have to be very, very altitudinous and senior to my fellows before I can have any space at all. If I were down there pitching with you kids, you see, the guy is saying all the time, if I was in there pitching to you kids, if I was in there with you sailors, something of that sort, why, I couldn't have any space because you'd block all my space out. Well, supposing this guy didn't have that sort of complex, he's liable to be the happiest, go-luckiest sailor you ever want to walk into, you know? Somebody come along and say, how about promoting you to Brigadier Admiral of the rear rank echelon or something? They say, are you nuts? What do I want all that viewpoint for? I got all the space I need right here. See? But the fellow who doesn't have any space right where he is has got to move in ranks upward. The fellow who doesn't have any space where he is has got to move upward on a higher echelon. Now, every once in a while, quite by accident, you get another condition taking place. Somebody is thrown up into an altitudinous position. This happens politically every once in a while. He said, gee whiz, you mean somebody's got to occupy this post? Oh, no. You mean nobody will be premier? Well, you have to go in and be premier, Joe. Oh, no. Look, you better go in and be premier. There's nobody else going to be premier, and nobody else can take it, and nobody else will, and so on. There's got to be one. And he looks around, and he sees that this is fairly well true, so he goes in and is premier. Only you'll find out that when this fellow is being premier, that the number of white gloves which are used to open the doors for him and the number of rose carpets which are being spread for him to walk across sidewalks, which should be, you know, according to the national budget, are strangely missing from the treasurer's expenditure list. Why? He's not trying to be just another fellow and just an everyday Joe or anything like that. It's just incomprehensible to him that he could be anything else. Now get that viewpoint. The politician who tries to be successful tries to mock up this mock-up. See? He tries to echo this mock-up. Hail, fellow, well met, and so forth, and goes around and kisses all the babies and so forth, and he's just sour. He'll get away with it now that we have TV and nobody can shake the guy actually by the hand. They just look at him in phosphorescent screens. They say, well, look, he's a human being. He has a nose and everything. He's a jolly fellow. They wait till after he's elected to start digging up stuff about him. That's because by this time they found out that he isn't quite this jolly fellow they thought, you know. But the easiest guy to know you ever wanted to know, the easiest guy to know is certainly the guy who can take yours and everybody else's viewpoint, and he doesn't give a damn. See that? He can still take a viewpoint of responsibility. He can sit at an executive desk and do one whale of a job of the whole thing, do 10 times as much work as somebody else who is super worried and aberrated and conditional about everything. Hey, he can do this job. He'd also just soon go back in the galley and sit down and eat pie. You see that? There's difference. He'd just soon drive his own car. Somebody says, well, now this guy is made general manager or something or other just because he artlessly has accidentally happened to do more work than anybody else around in the joint, and the stockholders all of a sudden drafted him for general manager. He's general manager. Well, up to this time, the general manager of the plant has had 18 hot and cold running secretaries. And he's had a chauffeur, and he's had this, and he's had that. And we give this guy, goes out, and here's the general manager's car, and there's a fellow sitting there at the wheel, and he opens up the chauffeur's door, and he steps in, and he says, okay, he says, you can go back to the garage now, I've got it. Oh, I'm supposed to drive you. Oh, you are? Why? Oh, yeah. Well, sit over there. We'll go for a drive. Next thing you know, the employees are seeing their general manager driving around. Fine, he doesn't like that car very much. It's completely dissimilar sort of a car to anybody else's car. It doesn't behave well, anyhow. You'll have to see him riding around there on a scooter. It's fantastic what such men can do with men. Fantastic. I've seen it take place. There was an old three-striper. He just never could seem to fill out all the papers necessary to get his promotion up to rear admiral of the second upper echelon or something. Only during the war came along and all of a sudden hung him with this rank, and he thought it was very funny. He went around his base in a set of dungarees riding a small scooter. It wasn't that this fellow neglected his job. He wasn't a hail fellow well met particularly. And he wasn't a bad guy, not by a long ways. His son, for instance, brought the cruiser San Francisco through the whole Japanese battle line and brought her out. He wasn't even supposed to be in charge. It's just everybody was dead, and except the senior officer of the ship who stayed in the engine room keeping the engines running while this young fellow up on the bridge, seeing that he had command of the thing, ably fought the ship out of a very, very rough position. It was one of the famous actions of World War II down in the South Pacific. Well, his pop ran the very best base you ever wanted to see. The old man was really terrific. But don't think, you see, he was perfectly capable of raising a good son, getting his son the responsibility in life. He didn't overmass this kid so that this kid is always pushing this way and that. No, the kid does his job when he has to do it. There's something to be done, do it. Don't think the old man was soft either. He wasn't soft. Every once in a while, he'd ride up alongside of some enlisted man that's standing there watching the job be done with his hands in his pockets, and he'd say, what unit do you belong to, son? And the kid, you know, new on the base, turn around and see this old duffer, probably warrant officer or something of the sort, riding this scooter, dungarees, no rank. And he'd say, oh, I just got in a late draft and so forth. And he'd say, well, why don't we lend a hand with this? Kid grab on one end of a girder while the old man grab on another end of the girder and finish up piling the girders or something like that. Or the kid would say, oh, I don't feel like working. Well, that's fine. You got 10 days bread and water. And over the whole thing was real casual. Well, there is somebody who is somebody. I wonder what the characteristic was of some of the most famous able people in history. There have been lots of famous naval people. in naval history. But there's one fellow who seems to outshine all the rest, a fellow by the name of John Paul Jones. What sort of a character did this man have? Do you have the kind of a character you were led to think by reading what the U.S. Naval Academy handbooks and so forth write about him? No. John Paul, who was the first boy to really lick a first-rate British ship, who put the American Navy on the map, who was the only person to invade the British Isles since practically 1200 and something, or maybe the Norman Conquest. John Paul Jones, you know, made a complete invasion of Great Britain, burned a harbor and everything else. Nobody ever did that. This guy, what sort of a personality this man has? Well, he certainly wasn't sold on John Paul Jones. This wasn't the only person alive. As a matter of fact, it was very hard to get him to find out there was John Paul Jones there. You'd find him at sea, down in the tween decks, teaching a midshipman how to dance properly, because the young man ought to be a gentleman, and the gentleman knows how to dance properly. And you would find him up there running a small contest with the steersman, showing that he could get the ship closer to the wind than the steersman, or the steersman showing him he could get the ship closer to the wind than John Paul. Or he'd be up forward refereeing a game of backgammon, or some such game. He was all over the ship. Nobody knew where the hell he'd turn up next. The whole ship was alive. The whole thing, from stem to stern, was alive. Any ship he ever commanded was alive. The amount of military discipline which he handed out was so slight as to be undetectable beyond one case. A fellow, while he was a merchant captain, a fellow down in the West Indies charged him and was about to do him in and so forth, and he shot the guy. He didn't consult regulations of the merchant marine and say, let's see, under these circumstances, you're supposed to shoot somebody. No, somebody's going to deal him in, so he just shot the guy. This haunted his career for some time because he had many enemies. He was so able that, of course, he was utterly detestable to early American naval officers. I'm not being sarcastic. I'm just being truthful. He many times lost his seniority on the captain's list. And so on. This upset him because you had to have seniority in order to get to sea to fight the enemy, and he was having a good time fighting the British. I actually don't think he was ever once mad at the British. This fellow didn't care anything about it. We find him ending up his career, by the way, in Paris, perfectly comfortable. Did you know he was also a vice admiral in Catherine the Great's navy? Well, he's quite a boy. I mean, he's all over the place, everybody. This is the sort of an excited being. The person who can see any viewpoint, be any viewpoint. By the way, he once challenged the Secretary of the Navy to a duel. He didn't like what the Secretary was doing, so he sent him a challenge. First man to do that. Quite remarkable. Here is certainly a person who is acting individualistically, but he isn't an individual. Now, you get the difference between the two things? In other words, he can assume a clear, precise viewpoint, any place. As anything. He can assume this as a clear, precise viewpoint. He keeps a game running, but the great glory and the terrific responsibility of being him always kind of seems to miss him. He never quite catches up with that one. Well, when we point out a character, you're not trying to tailor make any pre-clear into a particular set of characteristics. Didn't mean to run in on you. So much level of personality, but I think it's necessary to this degree. Have there been great men who succeeded, who could be everybody, and didn't give a damn for themselves? Yes, there have been. They just happen to be. This is an entirely different thing than the fellow who just can't bear to be with that crowd, and he's got to move back a step and to a higher rank. And the fellow who can't bear to be that crowd, and he's got to leave a pooch on Rome. You know, he's got to get in there and say, let's all do and die for the Romans and particularly me. And he isn't the sort of a fellow who just can't stand being a corporal, so he becomes a dictator. Those guys all fail. Now, let me call this to your attention very sharply. Every one of these boys, regardless of whether their names are Mussolini or Puccinski, if they are under a terrible compulsion to relieve themselves upward to where they don't have to associate with their fellow man, where they can command their fellow man, they fail. Inevitably. They do not win. They don't win their campaigns. They don't win their goals. They fall down. They become ill. They are very messy people. And there you get your Mussolinis and your Hitlers and your worldwide revolutions. Stalin had every opportunity to go on governing Russia with three companions. And he murdered three of them in cold blood because he couldn't stand the competition. This fellow murdered about 10 million mujiks, this Stalin. Murdered. He's thinking about it, you know, occasionally. He says, well, maybe it didn't have to be that many, but it probably did have to be, and so forth. Here's a leader, for instance, who has actually put his country in a terribly interesting political position. Of course, he hasn't made it any worse. It couldn't get worse, really, at any time. He apparently has done so much, but at the same time, he has destroyed tremendous quantities of liberty for other people. So there are your slave masters of the world. They are the people who cannot tolerate other viewpoints. And if they can't tolerate other viewpoints, they have to control other viewpoints. So we have two types of personality, one which is upscale and one which is definitely downscale. One which wins and the other which definitely fails. One which brings greater peace, harmony, and happiness to man, and one which brings him only misery and degradation. Those are two distinct personalities. That man who can be a great man and at the same time assume every other viewpoint there is really a great man. And that man who assumes other viewpoints simply because, time after time, he finds his position untenable is not a great man. He's a failure. He has compulsively become something because there was no other choice. He couldn't have any space occupying the strata of a common, ordinary, run-of-the-mill human being. He couldn't win that way, so he had to figure out some other way so that he goes on up the line. Now, there's your two different levels of operation. They're very distinct. Well, observe these in your pre-clear, please. The pre-clear that is having a rough time with his case is finding his current position untenable. After having found many other positions untenable, the dwindling spiral of his case was this. And this is true of every human being alive, even though he's a great personality, he still has found that this is the case. Somewhere or other down the track, he has learned that one human being after another, or one being after another, had a viewpoint which he himself couldn't tolerate. He has run into viewpoints which were detestable to him. It's very bad over that way kind of viewpoints. He's gotten viewpoint after viewpoint that he has been unwilling to have, and so has cut himself off viewpoint after viewpoint after viewpoint after viewpoint to a point where he can't look at anything anymore. And anybody who's having trouble with looking in any way, shape, or form, has occlusions or anything of the sort, just has too many viewpoints which he can't bear the thought of becoming. Can't bear the thought of being those viewpoints. There's your diagnosis on a case. If you're going to diagnose a case any way, shape, or form, many mechanical ways to do it. You can say numerical positions on the tone scale. You can say this, you can say that about cases. You can go on and on about cases, but you can't better, really, this one, and that is his viewpoint. There are two tests, actually, but one test is certainly not testable by his fellow man. Viewpoints is testable. We can find out how many viewpoints can this individual tolerate? And not compulsively, but by his own choice. And we look over and find out that it's a very great many. But there is another one, is what he knows. What he's willing to know is another test. But that's not a usable test, because it doesn't exist within space. It doesn't exist within energy, and therefore does not exist within data. So we can't make up a whole bunch of data and say to somebody, now, what of these data are you willing to know about, and get any kind of a conclusive test out of it at all. We wouldn't be able to do that. We're just giving a bunch of artificials and so forth, and you'd find that cases would be very ragged. If anybody ever tries to set this up, you'll find out that it could be made to look very good and is really poor. That is the test of comparable knowingness. How much does a person know, or how much is he willing to know? And that in itself is a test of tone, greatness, other things, you know, strength. Now, over here, however, is the reliable one. How many viewpoints can this individual tolerate? And that's the one you're interested in. If you're real smart, you'll just start in on your pre-clear. Every once in a while, as you run him, you'll ask him, okay, get a think of a detestable viewpoint. Okay, get the idea of being it. Watch his reaction. Watch the meter. Pretty soon, as he gets better and better, he has less and less objection. Well, this doesn't mean that you're pounding him down into apathy about it. That's what he's liable to diagnose if he were to have this explained to him. You say, look, he's getting me so apathetic that I'm deserting my own personality, and he's making me forcibly tolerate, gee, the viewpoint of horrible people like, prostitutes and doctors and jugglers. Oh, this person, look how this auditor is forcing me down. You never give him a chance to even say that because he doesn't analyze what you're doing. He doesn't really think about it too much. Those are pretty clear. You've got this boy capable, willing of assuming, I said capable and willing to assume any viewpoint in the universe. And brother, you got him capable. Because that's about the most capability there is. I'm not trying to teach you now how to be a chameleon. I'm not trying to give you the philosophy of turn your coat when you find it unhandy to wear it the other way over. That's not the same thing at all. You know, every once in a while somebody's come along to you and said, well, you have to be able to see the other fellow's side of things. Anybody ever tell you that? Well, they were enforcing a viewpoint on you. You've just got through with this guy, and he said, well, I think your throat ought to be cut, and you're kind of fond of your throat. And your mother came along and said, well, everybody's entitled to a viewpoint, and you should take this other voice. She didn't even know what they were talking about, you see. You're having it forced on you that you ought to assume other people's viewpoints. And so you negate against it. And there we go down spiral. Negating against other viewpoints. We don't want them. Truth of the matter is, all control really consists of, the most superlative control there is being able to assume any viewpoint. Somebody's having trouble with his liver, ask him to assume the viewpoint of his liver. If he's willing to have the viewpoint of his liver will get well. If he's unwilling to have the viewpoint of his liver, it will stay ill or get sicker. That's the final test. It'll even work on psychosomatic ills. Okay,